Chapter 3. Joshua.
May 12, 1923.
Joshua knew that he was gawking at the woman in red. There was really no other word to describe the way that his mouth hung open. He couldn't even bring himself to look at the barrel, not yet. He was looking at a bright, open smile, a short cap of black hair, and legs that seemed to go on forever before disappearing into a brief red skirt.
Even in the privacy of her own bedroom. In fact, even under the covers of her own bed, his late wife would never have worn such a bright, brief, revealing garment.
Joshua realized that he had removed his hat and was clutching it to his chest. He even reached up and tried to do something to straighten his tangled hair, as if such a woman as this would even notice him. A woman like that would have no need to look twice at a scruffy, gray-stubbled boatman. But look at him she did. She flashed him a wide, friendly smile as she was swept on by the tide of women.
Then, with a
mass exertion of feminine energy, the barrel and the woman in the red dress were both heaved onto the tailboard of the cart, and Evangeline Murray came to rest on top of the suitcases just behind Joshua's seat. Cornelia Braithwaite had also been hoisted up by her admirers, but her presence had very little effect on Joshua. Not until she clapped a strong, determined hand on his shoulder. "Mr. McLaren," she said, "this is our brave heroine. This is the woman whose name is going to become a household word. This is Mrs. Evangeline Murray." The only word Joshua could find to fit the occasion was, "Aye," and this he said several times. Nothing else seemed to come to his addled mind. In the absence of any action from his uncle, Danny took it upon himself to take up the horse's reins and start the homeward journey. "Up, Morag," he shouted in ringing tones. He was answered by a nervous twitter from Iris Devere, perched beside him in a confusion of flowers and lace, and a token movement for Morag. At a snail's pace, they proceeded past the cheering women. By the time they were clear of the crowd,
Joshua had managed to greet Mrs. Murray's expectant smile with a surly nod and to clap his hat back on his head, where he was sure it did absolutely nothing to improve his appearance.
Danny turned his head to talk to the ladies, ignoring Morag, who was perfectly capable of finding her way home. Joshua had allowed her to do so frequently when he was younger and when whiskey was easier to come by. "Is that barrel what I think it is?" Danny asked, asking the question that Joshua desperately wanted to ask. "That," said Cornelia, "is a barrel designed and constructed entirely by the Women's Freedom Movement of Sandusky, Ohio, and funded by donations through the Women's Free Press." Joshua laughed. He didn't mean to, but it simply came out. An unpleasant, unfriendly, derogatory kind of laugh. "In case you are still unaware of our position, Mr. McLaren," Cornelia continued, "I am the president of the Women's Freedom Movement, and Mrs. Devere is the—"
"You told me already," Joshua interrupted. The overblown roses on Miss Devere's hat nodded timidly. Cornelia continued, undaunted, "Just as soon as it can be arranged, Mrs. Murray will strike a blow for the freedom of women everywhere when she will sail bravely over Niagara Falls and emerge unafraid and unscathed as a national heroine."
Joshua laughed again, although laughing was the farthest thing from his mind. He had only too good an idea what a ride over Niagara Falls would do to the slim, bright body of Mrs. Evangeline Murray, and it was no laughing matter.
"You find that funny, do you, Mr. McLaren?" Miss Braithwaite asked.
"Oh, take no notice of him," said Nell, in an unusually determined voice. "He's a miserable old curmudgeon."
"There's nothing funny about it," Joshua muttered. "None of you have any idea what you're talking about. I would have thought that Nell would know better."
"No idea what we're talking about?"
Miss Braithwaite was full of indignation.
"No idea what we're talking about. I can assure you that I know exactly what I'm talking about. Don't you realize that a well-motivated woman can do anything she wants?"
"It's time for the women of the world to unite," Miss Devere said very quietly.
"We will no longer be ground down by the heel of male supremacy," Miss Braithwaite declared.
"It's just plain common sense," Joshua argued. "If you knew the river as well as I do—"
"There you go again," Miss Braithwaite said, "arguing that we have no common sense. You should come to one of my lectures. In fact, you should have a front row seat. My next talk will be on reproductive freedom."
"What?" Joshua gasped.
"Cornelia, I don't think that now—" Nell started to say, but Cornelia would not be silenced.
"Birth control, that's what we call it," she said. When Mrs. Murray rides her barrel over Niagara Falls, she will be the voice of all women everywhere who have ever wished to be free of the terrible curse of unwanted motherhood. Joshua heard Evangeline laugh for the first time, light and musical. "Come now, Miss Braithwaite, that's a very heavy burden for me to carry," she said. "Isn't it enough for me to represent all the women who have ever wished to succeed in a daring enterprise? And how are they to do that with unwanted children clutching at their skirts? No, Mrs. Murray, you will also carry the banner of birth control. Dear Margaret Sanger will be very proud of you."
"I'm sure she will," said Evangeline, "if she ever hears about it."
"Oh, she'll hear about it," Cornelia assured her. "The whole world will hear about it. I know my business, Mrs. Murray."
Joshua heard his own voice grumbling like an old man. "Never heard such nonsense. Sheer rubbish, all of it."
He took the reins from Danny's hands and concentrated on staring at the head of the old horse as she plodded down the road to the McLaren house. Arriving at the front gate of the house, Joshua made no attempt to unload the lady's luggage. He knew he should have, could have, leapt lightly from the seat and offered the dazzling Mrs. Murray his hand, and quite probably his heart. But instead, he sat like a miserable lump while Danny did all the hand offering.
"You can take the barrel down to the boathouse," Nell said.
"Can I now?"
"Joshua, you promised."
"I dinna ken what I was promised," he said, obstinately Scottish.
"Don't be difficult," Nell pleaded.
She glanced at the house, seeming very impatient to be inside with the ladies. Cornelia stood in the doorway, beckoning, but Joshua held Nell back.
"You're surely not encouraging this foolishness, are you?" he asked. "You know what they plan to do, don't you? It will be the death of that poor woman."
"It's a well-designed barrel," Nell argued.
"How can it be?" Joshua asked. "What does this committee in Ohio know about our river?"
Nell set her mouth in a straight line.
"You're just saying that because they're all women."
"No, I'm not.
I'd say the same thing if a bunch of men from Ohio tried to design a barrel to ride the falls."
"Nell, what is the matter with you? You've seen enough bodies pulled out of those waters. Do you want to see that woman's body pulled out too?"
They both looked across to where Evangeline stood in the doorway, talking to Danny. But Joshua wasn't seeing his own front door. He was seeing the whirlpool, 3 miles downstream from the Horseshoe Falls, where the river made a sudden 90-degree turn and formed the huge basin of the Whirlpool Rapids. Anything carried over the falls and forced down under the cataract would be swept downstream to the whirlpool. Trapped in the slowly circling water, animal carcasses, uprooted trees, and every now and then, human bodies would spin around and around until the whirlpool was ready to spit them out. Stripped of their clothes by the grinding rocks, the bloated corpses would rise obscenely to the surface. Evangeline Murray would be stripped of that red dress and round she would go, just like any other fool or suicide.
"Are you all right?" Nell asked.
"I'm missing a good day's work," Joshua grunted.
"Then go back to the boatyard," Nell urged. "Heaven knows I don't want you hanging about here with the face of doom. Take the barrel with you. We can talk about it later."
"I'll have nothing to do with it," Joshua said.
"Just go away," said Nell, "and take Danny with you. We certainly don't need him hanging about and staring at Mrs. Murray like that."
"She is pretty, isn't she?"
"I hadn't noticed," said Joshua.
"Of course not," said Nell.
But she smiled knowingly as she sent him on his way.
Evangeline, May 12, 1923.
Evangeline watched as the tall Canadian turned his back and marched away with his long, impatient strides. She was sure she had made a very poor impression on him. He was probably convinced that she was a conceited, frivolous publicity seeker. She smiled to herself. Maybe that's what she was, and maybe that wasn't such a bad thing to be. The teenage McLaren boy, who looked so much like his uncle, was still talking, but Evangeline wasn't listening to him. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see a distant glint of water. Down there, beyond the trees, and the long outlines of the boatshed, was the Niagara River. What little she could see of it looked smooth and unruffled, a good deal calmer than the waters of Lake Erie where she had spent her youth. But of course, they were several miles below the falls here, several miles below the turmoil.
"Danny, go back to work and leave Mrs. Murray alone," said Nell McLaren, shooing Danny with anxious hands.
The boy grinned. He had a wonderful smile. Evangeline could see nothing of that smile in Nell, but she had just glimpsed it in Joshua McLaren for just a moment when he had first seen her, and then it was gone, replaced by an expression of dour disapproval.
Come on inside, said Nell. Evangeline thought the house was charming with its solid stone exterior ornamented with green shutters and surrounded by lawns and flower beds. Early roses bloomed by the front door and climbed the stonework. The windows were set deep in the thickness of the walls as a reminder of the harsh Canadian winters, but on this day in May, the house warmed itself in the sun and welcomed Evangeline after her long journey.
You have a lovely home, Evangeline said.
Nell McLaren blushed. She had blushed almost constantly since their arrival, and she was not a woman whose appearance was improved by blushing.
My brother does the gardening, she said. He likes roses.
Evangeline raised her eyebrows in surprise. The grim-faced boatman had not looked at all like a man who would know a rose from a dandelion. Nell was blushing even more furiously and terribly flustered.
This is your room, Mrs. Murray, she said.
It's very pretty, Evangeline said. Green is one of my favorite colors.
Very soothing, twittered Iris DeVries.
That's good. You need something soothing.
I'm fine, Evangeline said, irritated. I don't need soothing.
And the room next door is for Miss DeVries, Nell continued. It's blue. Iris opened the door and the ladies looked inside. They were small rooms, containing little more than a bed and a dresser.
And what about Cornelia? Iris asked.
Well, Nell stammered, I don't know if we really have anything appropriate for Cornelia.
I know you are all used to better things. I've given you my own room, she said. It used to be my parents' room.
I'm sure it will be fine, said Cornelia.
I'll sleep on the cot upstairs, Nell said hastily.
Evangeline waited through the brief, uncomfortable pause that followed.
You don't have to, Cornelia said.
Oh, I'll be fine, said Nell. I want only the best for the movement, and you are the leader.
Interesting conversation, Evangeline thought. I wonder if Nell even knows what's going on here.
Cornelia shrugged her shoulders. I'm going to lie down and rest, she said. I shall need all my energy for the press conference. I would suggest that you all rest. How long until lunch, Nell?
Lunch? Nell repeated, and blushed again.
An hour, she said.
I think I'll go for a walk, Evangeline said.
Outside? Asked Iris.
I'll walk down to the river, Evangeline said. I might even put my toe in and see if the water's cold.
I should find out ahead of time, shouldn't I?
It was a feeble joke, and in poor taste, and was greeted by the other ladies with looks of shocked sympathy.
It'll be cold, Nell said at last. The ice melt, you know.
I know, said Evangeline. I was brought up on the lakes myself.
I didn't know that, said Iris.
Kelly's Island on Lake Erie, said Evangeline. My mother was the schoolteacher. I know a lot about water. She sighed. My husband drowned, you know, but I don't plan to do the same thing. She left them abruptly, unable to say any more.
She walked down to the pebble beach where the river lapped gently against the moored boats and found a sun-warmed rock. Lying back, she looked up at the cloudless blue sky and willed her body to relax. From the boatyard nearby came the sound of a hammering and sawing and someone whistling a plaintive melody with a Scottish lilt to it. The unseen whistler was giving a virtuoso performance, sending a heartbreaking lament into the quiet afternoon air. Was it the river man, she wondered? Was there more to him that met the eye? What sorrow had made him what he was?
Soothed by the melody, Evangeline fell into a dreamless sleep, which lasted until she found herself being patted on the cheek by a flustered Iris DeVries.
Wake up! Wake up, dear! Your face is getting sunburned. Your nose is quite red.
We can't have that, said Cornelia Braithwaite, staring down at her from great height. People will think you've been drinking. You'd better get yourself out of the sun.
Miss McLaren has lunch ready for you in the kitchen. We'll join you in a minute.
We're going to talk business to Mr. McLaren.
Then I'll come with you, said Evangeline, rising stiffly to her feet.
It's business, Mrs. Murray, Cornelia repeated.
My business, said Evangeline firmly. Let's go.
Oh, very well, said Cornelia, but remember to let me do the talking.
You're welcome to that job, Evangeline said. I don't think Joshua McLaren is an easy man to talk to.
He makes me nervous, Iris whispered.
Cornelia fixed her with a withering look. Everything makes you nervous, she commented.
The McLaren boatyard presented a very prosperous appearance. There were three large boat sheds, freshly whitewashed.
on the cement hard outside the shed were several boats still on their cradles and wrapped in tarpaulin to protect them from the winter winds. Other boats lay upturned on the pebble beach, and still others rocked on their moorings in the sheltered bay. Everything was spick and span, tidy, organized, unlike anything in Evangeline's life. They found Joshua McLaren in the largest of the sheds. A stooped, gray-bearded man greeted them at the doorway, stared long and hard at Evangeline's legs, and then stepped back to let them in. "Another one," he muttered. Danny McLaren bounded from the corner where he was sanding a hull. "Don't mind Maddie," he said. "He doesn't see many women." Joshua barely raised his head from his minute examination of the patch he was putting on a fine-looking mahogany boat. "Ladies, ladies," said Danny, "please come in. Sit down. Here, let me wipe the dust off for you." "Uncle? Uncle, the ladies are here." "Aye," grunted Joshua McLaren. After a great deal of fussing, Iris was seated on an upturned box, which she had dusted herself, employing a large, lace-edged handkerchief. Evangeline tried to stay at Cornelia's side, but Cornelia hissed at her furiously. "Stay out of this," she said. "Let me do the dealing. I understand this type." Evangeline remembered the plaintive whistling she had heard and wondered if any of them really understood what type of man Joshua McLaren was. But another look at the Canadian's grim face convinced her to leave the negotiating to Cornelia. Cornelia advanced upon Joshua, her hand thrust out. "Allow me to reintroduce myself," she said. "Cornelia Braithwaite." "Aye." Joshua reached into his pocket and pulled out a well-used pipe. From another pocket, he produced a pouch of tobacco and concentrated on filling and lighting the pipe. "What have you done with the barrel?" asked Cornelia. Joshua indicated a distant corner with a silent nod of his head. And does it meet with your approval?" asked Cornelia. Joshua McLaren shrugged his broad shoulders. "I haven't looked at it. It's nothing to do with me." "But of course it is," said Cornelia impatiently. "Why do you think we had brought it here?" She turned to Iris. "The papers, please, Iris." Iris fumbled in her large purse and produced a sheaf of documents. Evangeline saw a look of panic creep across Joshua McLaren's face at the sight of the printed papers. "I don't hold with papers," he mumbled. "Nonsense," said Cornelia firmly, thrusting the papers at him. "Read this, Mr. McLaren. It's a contract between the Women's Freedom Committee of Sandusky, Ohio, and Mr. Joshua McLaren, riverboatman of Niagara Falls, Ontario. If you will just sign your name at the bottom, we'll be all set for the launching. Of course, I'll leave the actual launch time to you. You know the best about the state of the tides." "This isn't an ocean, madam," said Joshua McLaren, teeth clenched firmly around the stem of his pipe. "We don't have tides." "Well then, currents, or whatever you call them," said Cornelia. "I've been told that the Canadian Horseshoe Falls offers the highest chance of success, so I shall insist upon you launching her from this side of the river. You must do it on a Saturday, early enough in the day to give the reporters time to phone in the news for the Sunday morning papers. Read it, Mr. McLaren. Read it." Danny McLaren stepped forward suddenly, offering his uncle a mischievous grin, and took the papers from Miss Braithwaite's hands. "It's a strange thing, Miss Braithwaite," he said, "but my uncle was just this moment commenting that he had forgotten to bring his spectacles with him today. I'll just read this for him, if you don't mind." "No need to read it, lad," said Joshua. "I'm not going to do it." Iris leaped suddenly to her feet. "Oh, Mr. McLaren," she said, "you must. You absolutely must. I mean, we have it all planned." She caught hold of Evangeline's hand and pulled her dramatically forward. "Evangeline is here and waiting. The barrel is ready. You have to do it, Mr. McLaren, please." "Iris," bellowed Cornelia, "stop that this instant. You're wheedling, Iris. These are not the Dark Ages. There is no need for a woman to go about wheedling. Sit down. Go on. Sit. You too, Mrs. Mary." "Now, just a minute," said Evangeline. "I can speak for myself, you know." She tried her most winning smile on the glowering Canadian. "Mr. McLaren," she said, "may I ask you why you won't do this? Are you opposed to women's rights, Mr. McLaren?" "Women don't need rights, Mrs. Murray," he said. "Women just need to be looked after." It was easy to be angry, easy to remember how very little anyone had ever looked after her.
"Looked after," she said furiously. "Looked after? Why, you patronizing—"
She paused. Words failed her, but Cornelia spoke for her.
"It's men like you that are the cause of our campaign," she said. "Yours is the attitude that we are pledged to destroy."
"It's a pretty generous offer, Uncle," said Danny McLaren, who had been studying the contract.
"Look here on page 2. Oh, sorry, I forgot about your spectacles."
"Oh, I can read figures, laddie," said McLaren, "even without my spectacles." The two McLarens exchanged a look that was full of meaning, which totally escaped Evangeline, and bent their heads to study the contract. Eventually, Joshua looked up again.
"Even so," he said, "I won't do it."
"And why not?" demanded Cornelia.
"Because there's already been one fool of a woman gone over the falls in a barrel."
"Yes, yes, I know all about that," said Cornelia. "Annie Taylor, 1901, a highly successful endeavor."
"It didn't make her rich, did it?"
"She was badly managed," Cornelia explained.
"She was a woman," said Joshua, as though that was all the explanation needed.
"We shall manage Mrs. Murray ourselves," Iris assured him. "She won't suffer the same fate as poor Annie Taylor. We're very good with money. Or at least I am," she added, rather uncertainly.
Joshua McLaren loomed over her.
"I've been pulling bodies out of this water for 40 years, he thundered. "I saw my first floater when I was just a lad. Suicides, most of them. Suicides and fools. Oh, aye, it's possible to go over the falls in a barrel and live. Annie Taylor did it. So did Bobby Leach. I helped to pull him out. 9 months in the hospital he was. Do you want that from poor Mrs. Murray?"
He turned to Evangeline. "Go home to your husband, Mrs. Murray, and forget about all this nonsense."
"Mrs. Murray doesn't have a husband," said Iris. "She's a widow."
Evangeline saw Joshua McLaren was looking at her very strangely, speculatively. He opened his mouth to speak, but was interrupted by Cornelia.
"How often do I have to tell you, Iris, that marital status is not significant? We cannot continue to categorize women by whether or not they are married."
"Sorry, Cornelia," said Iris.
Evangeline's brief moment of communication with Joshua was over. He was no longer looking at her, but was staring down at Cornelia, who was making a belated and ineffective attempt at charm.
"It's such a pity you won't do it, Mr. McLaren. Such a great pity. We were told that you were the best. I was told that you were one of the very few people who would be able to tow our brave Evangeline out into the river and launch her into the right current so that she might fall as safely as possible."
"Aye," grunted McLaren, "and I might kill my own self in the attempt."
"Oh," said Evangeline. She had never until that moment thought that she might endanger someone else's life.
"What my uncle means," Danny explained, "is that it's very dangerous for anyone, even as experienced as he is, to row out onto the river above the falls. He could be taken up by the current and swept over the falls himself. I'm afraid your offer is not generous enough for him to take that risk."
"We could make it higher," said Cornelia.
"Oh, no, I don't think so," said Iris, turning pale.
"It wouldn't make any difference," said McLaren. "I'm not going to do it."
"And that's your final word?" asked Cornelia.
"Aye."
Cornelia held out her hand for the contracts.
"Then we shall bid you good day. Come along, ladies."
"Now, ladies, ladies," said Danny, "don't be so hasty. I'm sure that with a little persuasion, my uncle would—"
"I would not, and that's final."
"It's a lot of money, uncle," Danny protested. "Are you sure?"
"Quite sure," said Joshua.
He withdrew the pipe from his mouth and looked at Evangeline. When he finally spoke to her, he spoke slowly, as though he were talking to a child or an imbecile.
"It's nothing personal, Mrs. Murray," he said. "It's just that I've seen too many fail."
His eyes clouded with distant memories, and Evangeline was momentarily touched by his personal pain. Before she could stop herself, she had reached out and touched his arm.
"I appreciate your honesty, sir. We won't trouble you any further. Perhaps you could suggest the name of someone else who might—"
He pulled away from her touch.
"There's old Duncan Campbell," Danny suggested.
"Not Campbell," said Joshua.
"He won't know his arse from his—"
"Oh," grinning sheepishly. "Sorry, miss. Madam." The gray-haired man who had hovered in the doorway dropped his own suggestion into the uncomfortable silence.
"Bill Hillsgrove and his sons," he said, in a painfully hoarse voice.
Joshua sucked on his pipe, thinking.
"They're not bad," he conceded. "But I don't really trust Bill's judgment. He'd be the best of a bad lot if you had to choose anyone at all."
"We are not changing our minds," said Cornelia.
"No," said Joshua wearily. "I don't suppose you are. But you'll not be able to do it on your own. You'll need experienced help."
He turned back toward Evangeline, speaking slowly again, spelling it out for her.
"You see, Mrs. Murray, they have to put you in a barrel up above on the shore, and then you'll be towed out and set free in the current. It has to be just the right spot. And then afterwards, someone has to go down, right below the falls, and pull you out, if there's anything to pull out."
He hesitated. "You don't want to do this," he muttered under his breath. "It's a terrible thing. Simply terrible."
Evangeline laughed. "It's only water, Mr. McLaren. I know all about water, and I'm a fine, strong swimmer."
Behind her, the gray-bearded man snorted. "Swimming don't come into it," he said.
"I've given my word," said Evangeline. "I can't go back on it now. If I were a man, you wouldn't expect me to go back on it, would you?"
"If you were a man, I'd punch you in the nose for being a silly fool," Joshua McLaren growled.
"Go and see Bill Hillsgrove, then. Maddie will show you where he lives."
Maddie smiled, looking down at Evangeline's legs.
"You lead the way," he said.
"Don't be such a fool," said Cornelia. "Go on, get out of here and be quick about it."
"I ain't never exactly quick," wheezed Maddie. "Shrapnel and mustard gas, you know."
"No, I don't know," said Cornelia. "I wasn't given the privilege of fighting for my country in the Great War."
Iris pulled at Cornelia's arms.
"Not now, Cornelia," she whispered. "I don't think this is the right time."
"Maybe not," Cornelia conceded.
"Come along, ladies, and we'll go and see Mr. Hillsgrove, if this noble, wounded war veteran will lead the way."
As they followed Maddie out into the sunlight, Joshua McLaren turned back to his carpentry. Evangeline glanced back. A shaft of dusty sunlight illuminated his strong features and picked out the red highlights in his hair and eyelashes. His hands, working patiently with the wood, seemed exceptionally large and strong. She wanted to turn back and ask him again, was it really so dangerous? Could she really die? Before she could speak, Cornelia Braithwaite grabbed her by the arm.
"Reporters," she said excitedly. "Outside, four or five of them. It's starting, Mrs. Murray, it's starting."
The moment of doubt was over. The bubble of excitement returned. She was going to do it. She was really going to do it.
"I'm ready," she said. "Do I look all right?"
"Wonderful," said Iris.
Evangeline smiled. She couldn't stop herself.
"All right, ladies," she said. "Let's go and talk to them. This is what we came for."
She looked back over her shoulder, teasing.
"Wish me luck, Mr. McLaren," she said.
He looked at her grimly.
"You'll need more than luck," he said. "You'll need a miracle."
Joshua, July 1893.
At 9 years of age, Joshua McLaren's red hair caused him acute embarrassment. Never mind that his mother told him he was like a freshly minted penny, everyone else called him carrots. As a result of which, and because of another problem which was beginning to plague him, he kept to himself. The one and only constant companion of his childhood was another outcast, Jumbo Bill Hillsgrove, who had passed beyond puppy fat into obesity at a very early age. Carrots and Jumbo spent a lot of time together in the heroic world of their imagination, where Carrots could become the brown-eyed, black-haired pirate captain, and Jumbo could be his rapier-thin first mate. They were, of course, beside themselves with excitement when the posters and flyers began to appear around town.
"The ultimate spectacle, a sight never before witnessed. A pirate ship, its decks crowded with exotic jungle animals, would be sacrificed to the gods of Niagara Falls."
Joshua's mother snorted in disgust, calling it needless cruelty. But his father grinned and said that some people would pay to see anything. Carrots and Jumbo made up their minds that this was a sight they weren't going to miss. They arrived early before sunrise to get a front row view. As the morning wore on, the excitement began to build. The crowd pressed in around the two boys, ladies with parasols, gentlemen in top hats, children in their Sunday best. But the two river boys clung tenaciously to their front row positions. They were at an ideal spot at the very brink of the falls. They could look upstream to see the approaching ship and down into the abyss to see the rocks where the ship would be crushed and broken. Just after midday, the murmur of the crowd grew to a roar. It was coming. The pirate ship had been sighted. Jumbo and Carrots craned their necks to see it. And there it was, coming down the river. "That ain't no pirate ship," whispered Carrots. "It's just some rusty old freighter," said Jumbo. "It ain't even got no sails." "But there's pirates. See up in the rigging?" said Carrots hopefully. The two boys looked again. "Cardboard," said Carrots. "They're just cardboard cutouts." The dilapidated old Great Lakes freighter was coming on rapidly, its unmanned engines running full tilt. "Where's the animals?" asked Jumbo. The posters had shown a fully rigged pirate ship, its decks crowded with striped tigers, glowering gorillas, and huge elephants. "I don't see no animals." A voice in the crowd answered him. "They jumped off," said, "upstream." "What do you mean?" asked someone else. "You mean there's no animals?" "It was just a couple of mangy old bears and some monkeys," said the first speaker, "and they jumped overboard miles back. At least that's what I heard." "It's a swindle," said Jumbo. Carrots looked at the approaching ship. He was sort of relieved. Now that he saw the ship heading towards the falls, he discovered he was glad there was no one on board. He was glad that those poor old jungle beasts were safely ashore. He was surprised to find that he really hadn't wanted to see the sacrifice. The ship was almost level with them. They could hear the steady thumping of the engines above the constant roar of the waterfall. Jumbo grabbed his arm. "It's going," he said. "Hear it breaking up?" The freighter was ricocheting off the rocks, and its hull was falling apart under the impact. "It ain't even going over in one piece," said Jumbo. "What a swindle." But then the bow of the ship reached the rim, and the crowd grew silent, holding its breath. The bow reached momentarily skyward and then plunged down. Down! The ship broke up as it fell, raining hunks of metal into the rocks and eventually disappearing beneath the foaming waters. "That weren't much," said Jumbo, but Carrots McLaren held his breath, staring down at the tumbling waters. The tons of metal, the boilers, the gears and pistons, the work of man, they were all gone. Their passing had barely disturbed the flow of the river. "Let's go down to the whirlpool," urged Jumbo, "and wait for it to surface." "I'm going home," said the 9-year-old Joshua. "But it was great," said Jumbo. "Don't you think it was great? I wish the animals hadn't gotten off. They should have put him in cages." Joshua shook his head. "They shouldn't have done it," he said. "And I'm glad the animals got off." "Sissy," said Jumbo Bill Hillsgrove. "Up yours," said Carrots McLaren, and at that moment their tenuous friendship came to an abrupt end.